everyone, and welcome to Margaret Beaufort, episode 12, Usurpation. For much of the 1470s, therefore, Edward was very keen to get his hands on Henry Tudor, and we might assume that his intentions were not honourable. And his attitudes towards Margaret must have been coloured by the knowledge that he wanted to secure her son and brother-in-law. Exactly what Edward wanted to do with Henry are a little moot, and very probably changed over time. But in 1471, the Yorkist succession was far from secure. Okay, the Lancastrian cupboard was largely bare of contenders, but on the other hand, Elizabeth and Edward were only just starting to fill the Yorkist cupboard back up again, if I may be slightly indelicate. Meanwhile, though, as in the words of Kenny Everett, Henry's incarceration in Brittany was all done in the best possible taste. The bars of the cage were well covered with taffeta. Edward, it was reported, took very grievously the news of Jasper and Henry's escape and their reception by Francis. And initially, Francis was very resistant to Edward's repeated requests that he hand Henry over to him, and Edward, truth to say, did not have much leverage. But Francis took precautions. In 1474, Henry and Jasper were separated, which must have been hard for them. Henry was taken to the chateau at La Joie, there to be guarded by Jean Quatre de Rieu. La Joie was safely well away from the coast, difficult to sneak a small boat to take someone over the sea to Skye in, or indeed to the Isle of Wight. They were looked after. The accounts of Francis II mentions things like purchase of clothes on the Breton account. But they were moved around, and the English servants were taken away from them to be replaced by Breton guards. The situation became even more dangerous in 1475 and 1476. Playing off France against England was always a fertile strategy for Francis II, and I suspect that if Machiavelli had met Francis, he'd have been a little shocked at the way he played off both ends against each other. What we have here, of course, is four parties: France, Burgundy, Brittany, and England. Edward was understandably a little miffed with Louis of France. After all, Louis had bankrolled an attack from his enemies, which had lost him his throne for a while, so generally that was seen as unfriendly. So Edward turned to England's traditional friends, who had helped them make such mincemeat of the old enemy back in the glory days, Burgundy and Brittany, helped, as we have heard, by his sister Margaret of Burgundy. Francis rather milked Edward's desire for allies against France, getting him to lend a contingent of English archers at one point, for example. And indeed, treaties were signed, and everything was ready, the Treaty of London with Burgundy and the Treaty of Chateauguiron. Both set Edward to attack France, and in 1475 it appeared that maybe Francis's boat had come in, because Edward IV decided now was the time to revive the glories of the Hundred Years' War and invade France. Meanwhile, Francis had been buddying up to Louis in the background and actually had zero intention of going to help Edward. Nor, it turned out, did Charles, though really not as bold as he claimed to be, of Burgundy. Edward did finally invade in 1475, but it was something of a farce. Since neither of his so-called wingmen turned up at the party, it was pretty clear he couldn't win. And he signed a peace treaty with the French king, equally eager to get rid of the English army. Edward's people were disgusted with him, and Edward must have been very disappointed. He'd made prodigious preparations and almost certainly had fully intended to fight. But France paid him to go away a bit like the Vikings and kept paying him a pension, and they agreed trade privileges with him to boot. Edward also gained Louis's promise that he wouldn't attack Brittany, which seems generous of Edward, to be fair, given Francis hadn't turned up. But Edward tried to use this as leverage with Francis and was determined that this was the moment to capture the only imp now left of Henry VI's brood. "He didn't mean the lad Henry Tudor any harm," he pleaded. "Just want to hook him up with one of my daughters." And Francis's treasurer, he backed up Edward's claims too. So hey presto, at last, Francis agreed. Henry Tudor was seized and dragged to St. Malo to be delivered to the English. Edward could smell his prize. Henry, however, was to prove that he was no fool. He played for time, pretending to be ill, and then legged it for sanctuary at the Abbey. And meanwhile, the Admiral of Brittany was begging Henry's case with Francis. And Francis caved in, changed his mind, and refused to send him off to Edward after all. It had been close, way too close. It is very likely that Margaret knew quite a lot about all of this through her husband Stanley. It's difficult to know exactly how much. But it would have been difficult, surely, for Stanley not to want to take Margaret's side, at least to some degree, and to warn her, to warn Henry. That he was sympathetic is borne out to a degree by his support for Margaret as she worked to find a way to alleviate her son's semi-permanent misery. Years spent on the run, well treated, but essentially a prisoner as he'd been for much of his life so far. But then, the thing is that Edward's attitude towards Henry changed. By 1482, he and Elizabeth had produced a string of heirs, an heir and a spare in Edward and Richard, and daughters too in Elizabeth and Catherine. They were growing up, and it seemed inconceivable that the Yorkist dynasty faced any further trouble. Edward was much more secure on his throne, especially after tipping his treacherous brother into a vat of wine, a most suitable end to Clarence's fickle career, however much Edward apparently regretted his ruthlessness. Meanwhile, Margaret continued to use Stanley's position to build her own knowledge and presence at court. In 1480, for example, when Queen Elizabeth gave birth to her final child, Bridget, Margaret was at Eltham Palace and given the highly prestigious job of carrying the baby to the font at the christening. It's evidence that Margaret was connected, recognised, accepted. It is, again, easy to judge Margaret as a manipulative schemer out to get her son onto the throne of England, but really in 1482 that would have required monstrous levels of optimism and ambition. And we know from Fisher, or at least Fisher claims, that Margaret was really something of a worrywart. Nope, it's much more likely that Margaret wanted just what any parent would want. She wanted her son home again, living a fulfilling life, according to his birthright. We don't know for sure. Of course, maybe she was a plotter, but by heck, she'd had to have been a wild optimist in 1482. Margaret seems to have had Stanley's support too, and together they now lobbied Edward. And excitingly enough, they found that they might be pushing at an open door. Around this time, though, just as things were looking up, Margaret also had a setback when her mother Margaret Beauchamp, the Dowager Duchess of Somerset, died. Nonetheless, Margaret persisted with Edward, and it's very likely that Henry also knew what she was doing. The pair seemed to have corresponded regularly. So finally, around June 1482, Margaret's efforts met with success. The death of the Dowager Duchess of Somerset gave an opportunity, actually, to discuss what would happen with her inheritance, and Edward agreed that Henry could inherit lands to the tune of £400 a year from her estate, which is substantial, and to be in the grace and favour of the King's Highness. Edward even had a pardon redrafted. It was real. After 12 years of tiresome exile, football was coming home. Well, less importantly, Henry Tudor was coming home. Hang out the bunting on the Siegfried Line. Interestingly, though, while Margaret appears to have been convinced by Edward's change of heart and was now vouching for him, it's notable that Edward also made alternative provisions for Somerset's estates, should Henry not accept the deal. So, for whatever reason, it seems that there was still doubt that Henry might suspect another trap or might not want to return. By 1483, Edward IV appeared to be in total command. True, he'd rather furiously declared war on France over Christmas as Louis callously dumped his agreement to marry the Dauphin of France to Elizabeth of York. But he showed few signs of raising a campaign. And although the fracas distracted him from Henry's return, Margaret would have remained hopeful. It's true that Edward by this stage was something of a porker, a phrase I have no doubt will get me into trouble since fat is a four-letter word these days. But look, it's noted that from being handsome and, how can I say, well-proportioned, by the age of 43 he was running to fat. And frankly, the French chroniclers laid into him as being the helpless pawn of extravagance and excess. Whether or not his death was due to some illness or stroke brought on by poor health, or, as Mancini, the visitor and chronicler, would have it, he had caught a chill from the river, Edward suddenly became very ill around Easter time, 1483, and though he rallied, within 10 days he died on the 9th of April. The English court was shocked and stunned. But never mind. Although youngish, Edward IV had an undisputed heir, also Edward, 13 years old, Edward V. And look, hey, Margaret Beaufort had given birth at the age of 13, so how hard could it come to become king at that age? Edward V was at Ludlow with his uncle, the Earl Rivers, one of the Woodville clan, and Rivers would no doubt bring Edward safely to London, and then there was the old king's brother there as well, Richard, Duke of Gloucester. There was the most powerful man in the kingdom, utterly loyal, as steady and reliable as a reliant robin. He'd no doubt steer the lad through his early years. So, let's not panic, everyone. Just breathe and relax. It'll all be fine. And indeed, Gloucester was clearly taking his responsibilities very seriously indeed. He wrote to Rivers and said he'd like to pay his respects to the new king. What direction would he be taking to take to London? Meanwhile in London, despite the divisions in the council between the factions of Woodville and others, Queen Elizabeth had taken control within 2 days of her husband's death and a coronation date had been set for the 4th of May. So Rivers and Edward V had reached the jewel of Milton Keynes, otherwise known as Stony Stratford, and that night, the 29th of April, 1483, Rivers rode over to see Richard of Gloucester at Northampton, and a good time was had by all. They were received with an especially cheerful and joyous countenance, and sitting at supper at the Duke's table, passed the whole time in very pleasant conversation. Ah, how lovely. Nothing wrong, nothing to see here then. The Duke of Buckingham also appeared. Well, the more the merrier, I say. Open a new bottle of sack there, boy. They all agreed, happily, amicably, and possibly slightly boozily, that Buckingham and Gloucester would join them in the morning. Well, in the morning was a train smash and no mistake. Gloucester told young Edward V that all the men around him, like Rivers, were actually wicked traitors. And Buckingham helpfully added that, as for his mother, women were not meant to rule, so she'd be the first up against the war come the revolution. Please. Edward should avoid getting the wrong impression. Gloucester and Buckingham were just loyal folk there to save them from the wicked Woodvilles. London, meanwhile, was in a ferment. The support of one William Hastings for Gloucester prevented a coherent and effective response from the Woodvilles, and by the 10th of May it appeared that the kipper had been suitably stitched. Gloucester was confirmed in a post of protector, as his brother had wished. The coronation of Edward V was postponed, although agreed. There was some sand in the Oyster. Elizabeth Woodville had lifted her skirts and legged it to the sanctuary at Westminster Abbey again. The abbot was probably beginning to think he should really keep a permanent suite of rooms available for her. She seemed to be in and out like a cuckoo clock. Also, she had young Richard, Duke of York, with her. This was inconvenient for Gloucester, since he was, of course, next in line to the throne after Edward V. But, to cut a long story short, the long version of which is in the History of England podcast, of course, By June 1483, Richard had persuaded Elizabeth Woodville to hand over her 10-year-old lad to Gloucester's tender mercy. He then had Hastings, Rivers and other Woodvilles executed without trial, and revealed that Edward IV had married before he married Elizabeth Woodville, and therefore all his children were bastards. Which meant that the real king was... Hang on, give me a moment. Oh, ooh, me! Golly, would you Adam and Eve it? The idea of a coronation for Edward V had disappeared from the calendar. Well, where was our heroine all of this time? As a council member, her husband Stanley would have seen all of this drama unwind in front of him. Although Stanley and Gloucester had worked more amicably together under Edward IV than their fracas in the northwest would suggest, going on campaign together, for example, the vibes were not great. Richard was asking his supporters, like Buckingham, to take on shiny new honours. All he asked Stanley to do was if he wouldn't mind standing aside while he got through the crush to shake someone else's hand. It is likely that Stanley therefore felt A. miffed, B. unloved, and C. nervous. Stanley actually spent a few days in prison, relieved by declaring publicly his allegiance to Gloucester. It seems likely the pillow talk back home was reasonably intense and that Margaret was therefore well informed and well aware that Gloucester's position rested firmly on the portly figure of the Duke of Buckingham, who was a Stafford no less. It's difficult to know Margaret's immediate reaction to Edward IV's death, what kind of personal relationship they'd built up with all the negotiating about Henry's status, but at very least, Margaret and Henry were back to the first of all possible squares, and that must have been frustrating. Now that Richard had set himself on the path for usurpation, he was once more all smiles to Stanley and his wife. He gave them an interview. He promoted Stanley at last as steward of the royal household. He offered to help with debt collection, a debt in France that Margaret, ever thrifty and eager to exploit her rights to the full, was eager to get hold of. And he gave Margaret the job of holding Queen Anne's train at Richard's forthcoming coronation, which was a signal honour. According to Francis Bacon, Margaret dissembled and oiled for England, taking the opportunity to plead for her son's rehabilitation as well as help in the credit control department. And I have to say from personal experience, it is always the fiercest people who work in credit control and are not to be messed with under any circumstances. On the outward show of things then, Margaret was taking the same approach as she'd taken with Edward IV. But I suspect, but do not know, that right from the start there was a difference. First of all, Richard was a usurper and one who had not traditionally been on good terms with her husband. Secondly, he had displayed his utter ruthlessness and paranoia, killing his political opponents without trial, disinheriting his own flesh and blood with some trumped-up story which had all the solidity of a misty morning in the desert. And rumours were starting about the princes in the tower too, whose servants had all mysteriously been sent packing. Margaret can have had few illusions then about Richard's feeling towards her son, even at this early stage. Most significantly, Richard's route to the throne absolutely inevitably involved strengthening exponentially Henry Tudor's claim to the throne by removing all those competitors, as suddenly Henry was no longer fidgeting way down in the line to the throne, so far back that he was parked metaphorically outside the public conveniences. Now all of a sudden, he was number three in line, behind Richard and his only son Edward, who was jolly young, and we all know about infant mortality rates in medieval England, do we not? It would seem impossible that Richard felt relaxed about Henry Tudor, and Margaret was no fool. Even as she walked down the aisle, holding Anne Neville's coronation train, I figure Margaret Beaufort was looking like a mongoose at Richard's weakest spot. And I am guessing that she was well aware that Richard's weakest spot was right there in the Abbey, and its name was Henry Stafford, the second Duke of Buckingham. Now, thank you for listening all. We will return in 3 or 4 weeks for the next instalment and discuss whether or not Margaret had a hand in the deaths of 2 small boys in the Tower of London. Don't forget that the Omnibus edition is out this week too. Many thanks for listening, everyone. Thank you so much for being members. Good luck and have a great week.